Well, you know, for the last several weeks, we've been dealing with the subject of the fear of the Lord and really how it impacts our behavior. And trying to get across to you the idea that Christianity is more than just getting saved, getting baptized, and joining a church. Though you might feel like that's emphasized at this church or any other church that you may attend. But really, it's about developing an ongoing, abiding relationship with our God. And I hope that this message will help you with that. Your interest in pursuing that relationship with God really hinges on how you think about it. You know, if you think of God as just the man upstairs, he's kind of, you know, good, but he might be a little bit grumpy sometimes. You might not have the right perception of God. And then there are other people that might think of him as a sugar daddy. You know, he's up there to dole out gifts for his children. Or maybe as a genie in the bottle that you just kind of wipe the bottle and the genie comes out and he fixes your emergency. But God's so much bigger than any of those stereotypes that are commonly thrown around in our thinking and in the world today. He is great, and he is powerful, and he is worthy of our praise. So I think as we go into the week of Thanksgiving, as I've already introduced, I don't think there's anything better that we could do than to focus on why we ought to be praising the Lord. And I can't be exhaustive in this. Just want to help you along as you think about Thanksgiving, to think about the God to whom we give thanks. To help you do that, I want you to go back with me to something that should be culturally known to most of us, and that's the old classic film, The Wizard of Oz. And you know that Dorothy, she lands in this strange world, and she wants to get back home. Along the way, she picks up three friends, and those friends are, right, the Scarecrow, and then the Tin Man, and then the Lion. They all have a need of something, but they're all going to go to Oz, and Oz is going to fix their problems. They get there. And finally, when they find him, you know, and they get him through the door and get into the building where Oz is supposed to be, he's terrifying. He's the great and powerful Oz, you know, and this makes you a little trembly. And so it did to all of them. And he wasn't going to, you know, answer their requests. He just demanded, snarled at them, "You got to go kill the Wicked Witch of the West." So off these four friends go, and the story, they end up killing almost by accident the Wicked Witch of the West. They go back with their hat and say, "Here's the proof." And this time, Toto gets away from Dorothy, right? And Toto runs over and opens up. Oh, yeah, you can hardly see it in that picture. It pulls back the screen on the man behind the curtain. And this old man comes out somewhat embarrassed that Oz turns out to be pretty much just a theatrical display and nothing really that great and powerful. If you'll let me today, what I'd like to do is pull the curtain back a little bit on God. But when we do, you're going to find him much more awesome than you actually think he is. In fact, I don't believe you can exhaust the grandeur, the greatness, the glory, the grace of God. He is off the charts. And all we're going to do is kind of like a miner who pans for gold. Maybe we're going to pull up a little flecks of gold from the riverbed today. But I don't know that we can ever dig out all the ore of who God is. He is huge and immense. So I'd like to I was thinking about where do I go in a message like that if that's what I want to accomplish. And I could have gone anywhere in the Bible. The Psalms are full of the glorious truth about the Lord. But as I was thinking about it, my mind was just drawn back to Deuteronomy chapter 10, where we've been recently studying the fear of the Lord, what it means to fear the Lord. And right in that context where Moses is urging the people, you need to fear the Lord, have a high regard for him, follow his ways. He gives them great reasons to, because the God he's asking them to fear is so wonderful. So would you allow me then to read from Deuteronomy chapter 10? Let's pick up where we started last week in verse number 12, and then I'm just going to keep reading down through verse 22. This is Deuteronomy chapter number 10, fifth book of the Bible, right after Numbers. And we read verse number 12, "And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul?
to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good. Behold, the heaven and the habit of heavens is the Lord thy God, the earth also, with all that therein is. Only the Lord had a delight in thy fathers to love them, and he chose their seed after them, and even you above all people, as it is this day. Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart, and be no more stiff-necked. For the Lord your God is a God of gods, and the Lord of lords, a great God, a mighty and a terrible, which regardeth not persons, nor taketh reward. He doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and widow, and loveth the stranger, in giving him food and raiment. Love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, him shalt thou serve, and to him shalt thou cleave, and swear by his name. He is thy praise, and he is thy God, that hath done for thee these great and terrible things, which thine eyes have seen. Thy fathers went down into Egypt with 70 persons, and now the Lord thy God hath made thee as the stars of heaven for multitude.
There's a lot in this passage. I'm going to boil it down just to 3 wonderful reasons why God deserves your praise this week and always. The first one is found in verse number 14. First, he owns it all. Let's go to that slide. He owns it all. Verse number 14 should be on the screen next. There we are. Behold, the heaven and the heaven of heavens is the Lord's, thy God, the earth also, with all that there it is. Clearly, the Bible maintains, right, that God made everything. And we're not so far removed from our creation seminar just a few months ago with Russ Miller, in which we learned that we not only believe that God made everything by faith, though there is an element of faith because we weren't standing there to watch him do it, all the evidence, much of the evidence, points in that direction and suggests that indeed it suits the evidence to believe that God made the world. The evidence abounds wherever you look into the heavens. In verse number 14, he says, behold, the heaven and the heaven of heavens. We would believe that the word heaven is referring to the visible heaven, the atmosphere, what we can see with the naked eye. And the heaven of heavens speaks of the heights of the heavens, or what's really beyond our eyes to be able to witness. He is the Lord and maker of those things as well, even the things we cannot see. Let me tell you about the Hubble telescope. We've mentioned this before. The Hubble telescope was put up in, I believe it was the summer of 1993. After they got it up there and tried to focus in on some things, they noticed there was a problem. Remember this? Well, some of you can remember that far back. And you remember back, and they had to send up some shuttle missions, and they had to scrape the glass to adjust it so that they could get good images. And finally, they got that finished up. And I think they got that work done in 1994. In 1995, around Christmas time, they did their first of the deep field explorations. DF is the NASA classification for this. They wanted really to use Hubble to help them to see beyond the local universe, if you can think of the universe as local, but just the stars in our Milky Way. They wanted to see things outside of our Milky Way. They wanted to see beyond what we could see from land-based telescopes. And so they chose for their first deep field study an area that would be correspond to above the North Pole, close to the constellation Ursa Major, and they focused on a dark area where there were no stars. And they explained it as holding a dime, the viewing area, holding a dime at 75 feet away. And that's about all, that just that little spot of space. And they focused in on that, and they allowed the exposure to go for, I believe it was about 10 days. And they took over 240 different photographs with the Hubble, and then NASA would splice them together and put them over one another. And this is the image that resulted in a dark area of space. Floods of light. They estimated that there were over 3,000 galaxies visible in this dark area of space. Now, they've done a bunch of deep field studies since, but this was the first one. And it's just marvelous to think that there's all of that out there, even where it seems to be dark and there are no stars shining. There's just more universe full of galaxies and billions of stars. As far as man can see, and even further still, there's stuff out there, and God administrates the whole thing. He's big.
the vast reaches of the universe belong to Him. And then if we come closer to home, all the earth, of course, the Lord is the owner of, and He administrates all that's going on. It may look chaotic to you, and it does to me at times, but God is administrating this earth just the way He wants it to be. God rightfully made it. He rightfully owns it because He made it. And when God made humankind, He didn't hold the administration of the earth back to Himself. I had Jim read Psalm 8 earlier in the service because God actually distributed some of the administration to us by allowing us to have dominion over it. For Thou hast made Him a little lower than the angels, crowned Him with glory and honor. Thou hast made Him to have dominion over the works of Thy hands, and Thou hast put all things under His feet. God let me administrate something He made. That's pretty neat and far beyond what I deserve. But I think we need to exercise some caution here when thinking about our administration of the earth. You know, I hope it's not true of you, but I think that even those that would believe that God made all things, God kind of made the raw material. He threw the ore out there. He put the gemstones and the minerals in the ground and the chemicals, but we have to find them. You know, and we have to kind of, you know, refine them, and then we've got to put them into useful things. And so we can take a little bit upon ourselves as humans because we've done the grand work of shaping the stones or manufacturing the computer chips. But I think we really need to exercise a little bit more caution in this regard. Because God not only provides the resources or the raw materials, He provides humankind the creativity to think, to be able to put all of that together to make something useful for mankind. So sorry, Apple. God provided the resources and the reasoning that led to the first iPhone. Sorry, Ford. God deserves praise for steering humans in the direction that automobiles would be a good idea. God is over all the heavens, and He rules all the earth. Here we are on the brink of another Thanksgiving, and we need to remember the importance of gratitude for our great God. He owns it all. And I want you to remember that Thanksgiving isn't just another excuse to have a bridge holiday and have 4 days off in a row. Gratitude is an acknowledgement of source. And I just buckle down or narrow down on that idea. Gratitude is an acknowledgement of source. It's stating that what I have would not be possible without the generosity of some giver. It was our founding fathers who started Thanksgiving on the shores of the Plymouth Colony. Later, our national leaders who codified it into a national day of Thanksgiving, not so that we could eat turkey and catch a football game, but to remember the giver of all things, without whom we'd all be in a world of hurt.
You don't even have to be a person of faith to understand that there's givers outside yourself, and gratitude is an acknowledgement that there is a source outside of yourself to whom the good things in your life would come. I think we need to be careful that we're not lulled into thinking that we are our own benefactors. That we are our own benefactors. We didn't arrive here on our own, nor can we sustain our heartbeats any longer than God said so. We need a source, and that source is God, to whom all the heaven and the earth belongs. And we're just getting started. I just gave you one thing out of verse number 14, the heaven and the heaven of heavens and is the Lord's, and all the earth and all things therein. He owns it all, and He deserves our praise. You pick up your iPhone on Thursday, you know, to call your family or to text those or put one of those emoji-loaded text messages, or maybe you put a GIF in your text so that what explodes with bubbles and balloons going all over the place on your phone. God allowed all that. He is the one, both with the resources and the reasoning to make that happen. Moving on, point number two. Next, let's look at Deuteronomy 10:15. Only the Lord had a delight in thy fathers to love them, and He chose their seed after them even you above all people as it is this day. The next great truth in this text about why God deserves our praise is He chooses you all. That's what He said. He delighted
in the fathers to love them, and He chose their seed after them. That's what verse 15 says. Now, specifically, this is talking about whom? The Jews, God's people. And we know them, this nation of Israel. We call them what? God's chosen people. Why are we saying that? Because God did choose them. It's also true that every believer who is ever, and every believer has been chosen by God. 1 Thessalonians 1 verse 4 says, "Know ye, brethren, the election of God. He does the choosing." So it is true, first of Israel. It's also true of every believer. We have been chosen by the Lord. Let me highlight two features of God's choosing. The first is initiation. Initiation. His initiation. Long before we asked Him, before He asked us to love Him, which He does in verse number 12, remember He said to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all His ways, to love Him. Those were all connected with the fear of the Lord and responsibilities that we had. But He initiates the process by loving us. And that's what He says in verse 15, a delight in thy fathers to love them. Before we were called to love Him, He loved us. That's a biblical principle. 1 John, what is it, 4:19, we love Him because He first loved us. And why did God set His love on such a people as the nation of Israel?
Well, you're in Deuteronomy. I turn back a page or two, but you're going to find this verse, Deuteronomy 7 and verse 7. The Lord did not set His love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any other people.
Rather, ye were the fewest of all people. You know, some have the notion that God chose them because they were a valuable commodity that God really needed.
You know, it's a good thing God brought me into His kingdom, because, man, this church would be in a mess if it weren't for...
Is it true that we're valuable to God?
It is. He did find us valuable, but that doesn't mean necessarily beautiful. God did not select us or the nation of Israel on the basis that we brought some kind of inherent virtue to Him. The opposite is true. We had nothing to offer, and He decided to lavish on His love and grace.
Let me give you an example of this. There are many examples. Let me give you a Bible example first, and we'll talk about marriage, and this all works together. You'll see in just a minute. First, patriarchs. You know, the patriarchs, the founding fathers, we would call them, of the Jewish nation, right? We have Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, all right? None of them were perfect. Abraham went down to Egypt and he lied. Isaac, he had trouble during a famine. He went down to Abimelech and he lied in the land of the Philistines. And then Jacob comes along and he's the worst of all of them. Let's just focus. He comes out, twin brother, he's grabbing his heel on his way out into the world, right? We know him as trickster, supplanter, deceiver. And that's the way he spends his life. He not only is grabbing his brother's heel, later he takes his brother's birthright, and then later disguises himself to steal the blessing. And he takes all of it from Esau for himself by his own muscle and fleshly willpower. And you think, man, if anybody needs to be put on a shelf somewhere or put in a ditch somewhere, that's Jacob. But God takes Jacob away under Laban for about 20 years, in which God just refines and pushes and kind of puts Jacob in a crucible, to where Jacob comes back to the land and he's actually somebody he can use. And in fact, he's still wrestling on the borders of the Jordan with the angel of the Lord. But God takes Jacob, I'm making this a little bit too long, let me get to the point. God takes Jacob, changes his name to Israel, which means prince with God. And then through Jacob, all 12 tribes come. And when we think of Israel, really thinking of the sons of Israel or the sons of Jacob. God used him not because Jacob had something to offer God, but because God is good and gracious and generous with Jacob, as he is with any one of us. He chooses to love the unlovely. Now, let me digress from the message for a little bit and talk about marriage. It's the marvel of marriage, isn't it? Two people are drawn in love to each other, and they enter into marriage. And then the honeymoon wears off. Sometimes in 24 hours, sometimes in 2 weeks, sometimes in 2 years. It's different, but when it eventually. And each may stand back thinking, what was I thinking? It is then that if you purpose to honor God and honor your spouse, your love has to grow, develop, and mature. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. I'm just trying to draw a parallel how God chooses the unlovely. But it means that if I'm to love my spouse, I have to love her. Husbands, especially husbands, love your wives, even as also Christ loved the church. Now, I got to love her like Christ? What does that mean? It means you got to love unlovely things. You got to love a person even when they fail. You got to you got to find a way to love when the imperfections start becoming irritations. And God is trying to grow you, but he's also trying to do something else. He's trying to display his infinite love in a small way through your marriage. So don't think yourself strange that I have to be adjusting and growing in love. God's trying to teach you to love like he does, which means love, being lovely in your marriage. That's exactly what God does with each of us. When we show ourselves to be most unlovely, and you know, most of you in this room know that, you're dripping with sin. There's no reason why God should choose you. Somehow he got a hold of your heart, convinced you that Jesus died in your place, sent down by God to die in your place, so that you could go to heaven and he could take away your sin. And you believe that because that's what God does. He chooses people. He initiates. He sent Jesus before anyone in this room came along because he knew you would need a Savior. But God commendeth his love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. This message isn't about the gospel, but if you're here without Christ, this is the thing you most need. God chooses you all, but he chooses us in Christ. He initiates, but you have to believe, you have to respond in faith. There's a second thing I want you to see about God's love in choosing us. Not only his initiation, but secondly, elevation. And we see that in the words in verse number 15. God chose you, his seed after them, above all people. Above all people, he chose them. He chose Israel above all the other peoples. He could have chosen a bigger nation, a more beautiful nation, a more obedient nation. That would have helped. But God picked them, and that remains the truth today. Israel is still the apple of his eye. Despite her present troubles and blemishes, she's still the apple of his eye. What was he thinking? I don't know. I still can't figure out why he picked me. Because I know enough about myself not to be standing here. I know enough about myself not to be worthy. I know enough about myself that I don't deserve to be in the family of God forever. So how did I get in? How'd you get in? How did any of us get in? Most of us aren't here or not belong to the Jewish nation. We're Gentile branches, which the New Testament says have been grafted in. We got a little bit of life into us, but it's just because there was this miracle. There was a splice in the tree and a new branch put in, and I can live through Christ even though I don't belong to the Jewish nation. And so we have, pardon me for mixing metaphors here, but we've been grafted into the tree. That should be coming up next. And we have been adopted into his family. Take your pick. Both metaphors work. We've been grafted into the tree or adopted into the family. Either way, we've been elevated by God's choosing. I want you to think about this. In a few days, we're going to be seated around a table, often with family and you're trying to squeeze people in around the table at Thanksgiving. Next slide, please. So I'm very grateful. We're all going to be very grateful. Hopefully that there's some kind of meat on that table and some trimmings to go with it. And we're going to be grateful for another year of life. We're going to be grateful for another year, another day of health. Grateful to be around those that we call dear. But remember, your table on Thursday is only a foreshadowing of a much greater table when all the people of the kingdom sit down beside Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom. And we who are Gentiles, they're going to make a room for us at the table. It isn't just for the Jews. It's for the Gentiles who believe in the Jewish Messiah, the Prince who came, the Prince of Life who gave himself in our place. This is our hope. Next slide, please. Where did that slide, where did that picture go? No picture? Oh, I hate when the computer doesn't work. Wait, there it is, around the table. That's what I'm looking for. Great. Throw down the verse. That's what I'm looking for. And I say unto you, that many shall come from the east and the west and shall sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Your feast is only a foreshadowing of a much greater feast, because God has elevated you above all the peoples of the earth to be part of his family, to be seated at his table. I don't know about you, it's lifting my admiration and my regard and my respect for my God. I'm committed to him. Because he's already committed himself to me, not just for time, but also for eternity. Great is the Lord, worthy to be praised. It's his name and his alone that deserves our praise. Finally, in verses 17 through 22, he cares for all. Verse 17 kind of reads like a doxology. For the Lord your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords, a great God, a mighty and a terrible, which regardeth not persons, nor taketh reward. That kind of sounds a little odd to us, but in the ancient Near East, it was common when you wanted to praise a deity that you just would heap title upon title upon title upon title, and that way you express the majesty and the plurality of all these various virtues that are true of the deity. Common practice, not just with the Jews, but also other peoples in the Middle East from that time. The title Lord of Lords and God of Gods, characteristics, great, mighty, terrible. Lord of Lords and God of Gods is not, incidentally, an acknowledgement that there are other lords or other gods. God's just saying, I'm second to none. There's none other out there but me. The characteristics here, great, mighty, and terrible, we get great and mighty pretty easy. He's the greatest and the strongest. The word terrible is a little bit unusual to us, makes us tremble. But the word is related to the word fear, same root in our text here. It means to have a high regard for God that results correspondingly with a cautious restraint in our behavior. That's what he's talking about. God is great. He's mighty or powerful. He's also one who's to be feared and held in high esteem. These being true, Moses sets out to assure us that this God truly does care. You might read the titles in verse 17 and go, oh dear, if I have to stand up to this God, I'm in trouble. But in verse 18, he comes back and says, no, it's okay. That's what you want, because this kind of God can care for you. And it starts with his justice for the helpless. Verse 18, he doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and the widow, love of the stranger, and giving him food and raiment. So that leads, next slide please, he cares for all. That was out of place. Let's go to the next slide. There we go. Justice for the helpless. Justice for the... He cares because he can be just to all people. In verse number 18, he mentions the fatherless and the widow. This is the orphans and widows mentioned throughout the scripture as being the special objects of God's favor. Because they're weak and vulnerable, he stands up in their defense. No one else may care for them, but he will. And he also mentions here, loves the stranger. He taught Israel to love the strangers. And in our text, he says, because you were once strangers. Did you see this? Verse 19, love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. When was Israel strangers in the land of Egypt? There were strangers there for 400 years under the Pharaohs until Moses brought them out. Stranger here doesn't mean somebody you don't know the way we use it. It means a resident alien, a foreigner. and God cares for them.
You know, it's hard not just to be an orphan or a widow, but a resident alien often, because they don't know the language, don't know the culture, don't have the right educational background. Many times just get unskilled labor jobs just to support themselves. But God, again, looks out for them, provides necessities like food and clothing. And he does the same for each of us because he genuinely cares.
I like the fact that God cares for the little guys. I don't know about you. Sometimes I feel like a little guy. Like nobody knows my name. But somebody does know my name. And the one who knows my name is going to take care of me and protect me from the bullies out there, because he's big enough to help the helpless. Debbie is a pastor's wife in New York City. This story is probably 20 years old or more. She's a church planner's wife. Matt Recker's her husband. He's planted 3 churches in downtown New York. I think Bronx, Queens, and one other place. So he's just moved around. He's on his 3rd church, doing a great work for the Lord. One day, Debbie was pushing, at this time, a stroller down the streets of New York City. Now, the fact that a church planter in New York is pushing a stroller, I'm pretty sure it was during the daytime, though I didn't read that when I read the story. But she's pushing it down the street when she hears behind her people approaching. And immediately she begins just to sing songs. Now, why she thought of this, I don't know, but she began to sing some hymns, church hymns. And a split second later, she was surrounded by 3 men, each with drawn bows. However, she was she froze, stopped in place, but she kept her composure and calm. And though she didn't immediately say anything, she kept just singing the songs that she was singing. And when she finished the song, she invited them to church. I think they were completely flabbergasted. They didn't say anything to her, but they withdrew their weapons and walked away. And God protected this church planter's wife in downtown New York from catastrophe, because God protects his people. He knows the little guys, and he provides justice for the helpless.
Finally, we're told not just his care for the stranger and the widow and the orphan, but in verse 22, thy fathers went down into Egypt with 70 persons, and now the Lord thy God hath made thee as the stars of heaven for multitude.
Let's finish up with the generosity of his people. He's generous to them. They only had 70, and when they went down there, they started multiplying. But if the Egyptians would have had anything to say about that, how far would the Israelites have made it? Remember, they tried to exterminate all the firstborn male, all the males, actually. God eventually took their firstborn males in response, but tried to exterminate them. Yet God multiplied them there and brought them from 70 to probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million by the time they marched out, because God is generous with his people, just as he is with each of us.
The fact that you survived another year is proof God cares for you. The fact that you're going to have more people around your table, or maybe not your table, but somewhere in the country there's another grandson or granddaughter going to be at the table this year, because God's added to your family and to your heritage and to your legacy, because God is multiplying you. God is generous. But maybe your table will also have one less plate this year, because God's taken someone you love. But God still cares. In every season of life, the highs and the lows, the losses and the gains, there's a God who cares. Cast your care on him, for he cares for you. He truly does care. Why is God great? God is great, worthy to be praised, because he is good, and because he owns it all, and he chooses you all, and he...
Oh, what's the last C word?
This left my mind. Cares, thanks. Cares for us all. Let me finish this way. I want you to leave here thinking about, let God be praised because he is worthy of our praise. This week I read a story about Major Steve Beck, a U.S. Marine, who tells us about, in his book, Final Salute, talks about the salute that's not taught in basic training, but it's for a fallen comrade on the field. And when a comrade falls on the field, the men are trained to salute in a very special way. They start, and it takes them about 3 seconds to lift their hand to their forehead. They hold it for 3 seconds, and then it drops away for 3 seconds, or about 9 times longer than it normally takes to make a salute. And it is a tribute or an honor to the comrade who has fallen in the name of his country and for his comrades on the field. And in this way, they want to honor the memory and the legacy of such a dear one.
A salute, then, a final salute to a fellow comrade. It's a great honor. That person is worthy of a slow salute, worthy of a little extra time.
On this Thanksgiving, I want you to think that away about your God. He is worthy of extra time, an additional salute, a little bit more. And rather than rushing through what you're going to do, slow down and show worth